From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. It's been a challenging year for John Perez, Speaker of the California Assembly. Along with the chronic budget problems facing all legislative leaders, Perez also had to deal with questions from critics about his leadership. Perez keeps a low profile in the news media, lower than some of his peers and predecessors at any rate, but he sat down recently for an extensive one-on-one interview at our Capital Bureau. Topics included a frank assessment of how Perez did this year, what the legislature can and can't do about the weak economy, and what he thinks about the governor's frustration with the volume of bills coming out of the legislature. Perez spoke with Capital Public Radio state government reporter Ben Adler.
Mr. Speaker, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So the legislature's done till January, barring any special session. What do you think of your work this year so far?
I actually think we had a very good year. When you look at the beginning of this year, we started off the year with a $26.8 billion budget deficit. $20 billion of that was a structural deficit. Over the course of the year, working with the governor, we were able to pass an on-time budget, solve the entirety of the budget year's deficit, and solve 75% of the structural deficit. So our structural deficit has gone down from $20 billion to $5 billion. Unprecedented in California, and I think unparalleled in the country, the progress we were able to make. As a result of us passing the budget on time and making sure that it was adequately balanced, we actually saw California's bond rating go up. Now, that is historic in that we've traditionally gone in the wrong direction. We started off the year with the same bond rating as actually a worse bond rating than Libya, and now we're moving in the right direction. This happened at the same time that at the national level, because of the prolonged debate around the debt ceiling, we actually saw the credit rating of the country go down. So California is absolutely on the right track, and we were able to make huge strides in getting our economic house in order.
A lot of voters don't necessarily seem to think too highly of the legislature, especially in recent polls. It's never that high, and 15-20% or so. What would you say to voters who do feel that the California legislature is dysfunctional?
You're right. It's historically been that way, and part of the dysfunction, a part of the structural problems that we have is voter-initiated. It's the fact that we've passed term limits and given people only 6 years to work together and on a maximum basis. And it's a fact that we've so constrained the hands of the legislature. When you talk about the work that we were able to do to close the budget deficit, we were working within very, very tight sets of constraints. Through the initiative process, we've declared where most of the money in the budget has to go. And through a series of lawsuits and the action of a federal overseer in the Department of Corrections system, we have very, very limited sets of options. So we're not always happy with the sets of options we have. But what you saw this year was the legislature and the governor working together to make meaningful structural reform and to close the budget deficit in a way that was unprecedented.
Moving towards bills at this point, the governor's talked a lot lately about how frustrated he is with the hundreds of bills on his desk, comments like a fire hose that you have to drink, not every human problem needs a law, and there's not 600 problems that we need those solutions for. But I'm sure that you probably take a lot of pride in the work that you do and your colleagues do in the legislature. What do you make of the governor's comments?
I think that's the difference between the role of a legislator and the role of a governor. Here you have 120 legislators, 80 in the Assembly, 40 in the Senate. Each of them represent very specific sets of communities, and so they want to address issues that are particularly important to the geographic areas that they represent, to the people that they care deeply about. And obviously, when you have 120 points of views, you're going to have more issues that you want to bring forward than when you just have one. The governor is one individual. He has a statewide analysis, but he doesn't have that same depth of relationship in each of the communities that the legislators do. And so as a result, you get all these bills, and the governor's trying to wade through them. I understand the frustration because I have to look at every bill as it comes to the floor. But the reality is that this is what democracy is about. It's about having representative leaders come, vigorously debate ideas, put them forward, and then the governor evaluate what he wants to actually sign into law.
So if he vetoes a couple hundred bills, are you okay with that?
Depends on which of the couple of hundred they are.
Well, and that brings me to the question of what are some bills that you want him to sign that you're really not sure if he's going to sign or not, some of those in the gray area?
Oh, I think everything's in the gray area until the governor says that he's going to sign it. You know, obviously for me, one of the biggest issues has been focusing on job creation. So my bill, AB 29, which creates the Office of Economic Development, I think is a crucial one. Just this week, the Orange County Business Council talked about it being one of the most important pieces of business-oriented legislation in the state. I've got another bill that creates the California Organized Investment Network, AB 624, which helps us find voluntary ways for private business to invest in underserved communities. Huge economic stimulus value. There are so many good bills that are down there right now that the governor's wading through that we know are going to make a difference. Last week, I was with him in San Francisco as he signed into law a bill that allowed for us to be the host for the America's Cup. Huge economic benefit for not only San Francisco, but for California in general. And then we signed into law AB 155, which creates e-fairness, finally having online retailers collect the taxes that bricks and mortar retailers have been collecting forever. Huge in terms of impact for revenues for the state, huge in terms of creating a level playing field between the online and bricks and mortar retailers. Very important in terms of setting a national framework for how we should be doing these things. So I think there's a lot of stuff before the governor that is really going to be very positive in terms of its impact on jobs in California.
Each year, the end of a legislative session rolls around, and there's a lot of big bills that spring up at the last minute, and that tends to lead to criticism over a lack of transparency in the legislative process, especially on controversial bills. From your perspective, what's behind the last-minute flurry of new bills? Why does this happen?
Sometimes it takes a while to get to consensus, and once somebody gets to consensus, they want to immediately have it memorialized in law. So that sometimes happens. People are deadline oriented, unfortunately. Look at the number of people who don't file their taxes till the last minute. It's not that they didn't have an intent to pay them, it's just that last minute rush gets them to get there. And so when you have tough issues, this Amazon bill is a perfect example. We had been all year long, actually for 3 years, working on this e-fairness issue. And so there have been bills each of the last 3 years doing it. All this year, we had three different pieces of legislation that worked their way through the legislative process. But it was only in the last week that we were able to put together the final deal that brought all the parties together. Should that have meant that we waited another year? No. It means you strike while the iron's hot. We had vetted the discussion very broadly, but now we had a solution that came together in the final moments. We acted on it. The governor signed it. It's a win-win for the industry, and it's a huge win for the state of California.
At the same time, there are bills that Republicans were very frustrated with, including the bill that would allow child care providers to unionize and the one that would place all future ballot measures on November general elections rather than primaries.
There are, and there are lots of things that the Republicans do that frustrate other people. I mean, that's the reality of politics. But again, these are issues that have been vetted for a long time. I was on a blue ribbon task force on the initiative reform 10 years ago, long before I was ever in office. This notion of putting ballot measures on November general elections was talked about then. We kicked it around as one of the things that the state ought to do. In fact, 18 of the 24 states that have the initiative process only allow for it on a November general election. Why? Because the whole notion of an initiative is to give the people in the broadest sense a choice in making decisions about how we govern ourselves. So that actually argues for us putting it on a ballot with the greatest level of voter participation, which is the November general election. It's consistent with what our Constitution said. The reality is Republicans don't like it because oftentimes they like to game the system and put issues on the ballot when the least number of people are going to vote. If you're going to have something rise to the level of direct democracy, we ought to do it in a time that creates the greatest participation so that the greatest number of people have a say in the decisions we make.
We're talking with the Assembly Speaker John Perez. And Mr. Speaker, a lot of Californians are scared about the economy right now, and they feel like they want to see their elected officials do something about it. Do you want to see the governor call a special legislative session before the end of the year?
Look, I don't think that a special legislative session is the solution. Under Governor Schwarzenegger, we had more special sessions than we had ever had before and probably than we'll ever see in the future. But having a special session doesn't get you solutions in and of itself. Good legislative approaches get you the solutions. The frustrating thing for the electorate and the frustrating thing for us as elected officials is you can't legislate a good economy. You can do certain things to make business operate in a more fluid way as it interacts with the state, but you can't just legislate economic change. So what have we done? We've tried to figure out ways in which to do reforms in the way that the government interacts with private enterprise so that they could expand their businesses. We did stuff to streamline the regulatory process, legislation that says future regulation has to be weighed on its economic impact. We did work to create the first of its kind in California, green manufacturing tax credit, brought thousands of jobs online. We did work to focus on transportation and transit-oriented development. Why? Because we know that as the economy grows in the future, one of the huge parts of California's economy is goods movement. The access to the ports, both in Southern California and Northern California, make us a huge player in international trade. So we need to do the infrastructure investment so that we're able to fully take advantage of the trade that could come through California. But if there were a silver bullet that could come up in a special session, we would have seen it come up through the regular legislative year. Now, if somebody comes up with a great idea, I'd be the first to say, hey, let's come back into session, let's work on this, let's get it out. But there's a lot of methodical work that needs to be done. And quite frankly, this is a global economic crisis that takes both a national approach and a global approach to try to turn around.
I suppose if a couple of Republican votes in the Senate appeared for the tax package that died in the Senate in the final night of session, that might be worth it.
That's worthy to come back because that would bring $1 billion to circulate in the California economy. It would give tax relief to manufacturers in California. It would give tax relief to individual taxpayers. That would be something worthy of coming back.
A lot of debate right now among Democrats about what kind of tax measures to place on the 2012 ballot in November. The fundamental problem seems to be that the taxes that would raise the most money are also the hardest to pass. Are you leaning in any particular way right now?
No, I'm open-minded in terms of what we need to do. I think we need to be thoughtful about making sure that we don't overly tie our hands of what we do with the revenues. One of the problems California has is that we have so dedicated specific revenue streams for specific purposes that when you get into moments of economic crisis like the one we're in right now, we limit our options and it undermines our ability to make the strongest choices and the smartest choices we can to weather the storm. So I'm open to anything that is generating revenues that is not overly onerous on a specific part of the economy and that helps us screw our way out of the morass that we're in.
Isn't that also the hardest to pass in that you have to tell voters, just trust us, we'll make use of the money, and Republicans could argue that hasn't worked.
No, I think voters want to know that we're going to use their money effectively. And I think that when you see the progress that we made this year in closing the structural deficit, they see that. But on the same hand, they're frustrated by the fact that we've had to walk away from certain investments. In this budget crisis, where we closed a $26.8 billion deficit, we were able to hold the line on K-12 education so that we got the same level of funding this year as we had the year before.
Unless
but quite frankly,
short of the trigger cuts kicking.
Correct. But right now we're targeted at a constant level of funding with the previous year. Many of us would have liked to have had more money for education, but because of the constraints, we couldn't get there. We need to have the flexibility to make the best decisions that we can. And unfortunately, we're overly constrained.
And Mr. Speaker, I do have to ask about some of the criticism you've gotten about your leadership style. And perhaps a few weeks back, a column by the Sacramento Bee's Dan Moraine boiled it down. And he said, quote, Perez came into office with a reputation for being a savvy inside player with keen political instincts. He is not as advertised. And then he goes on to call you insular, ham-handed, and a bully who doesn't seem to understand that a leader shouldn't stoop to meaningless fights with individual legislators. What goes through your mind when you hear criticism like that?
Well, first of all, Dan Moraine has never been one of the people who gave me any of the complimentary statements that he ascribed to me on going into office. Dan has never written a positive word, much less sentence about me, so you have to take that with a grain of salt. And quite frankly, I think this is one of those places where he just advances an accusation without any real foundation for it and lets the story write itself. And quite frankly, it's unfair and it's not true. We have the greatest level of unity in the Democratic caucus and quite frankly in the assembly that we've had in a long time. Had we not, we wouldn't have been able to get the solutions that we did this year. Had we not, I wouldn't have been able to put together the key Republican votes that I was able to put together on a variety of issues. Quite frankly, we have a very positive working relationship in the assembly within the Democratic caucus and then across party lines. I have Republican chairs, which is really not something that often happens.
Committee chairs?
Committee chairs, which is not often something that happens when you have overwhelming Democratic majorities. But I put Republican chairs in place because I wanted to make sure that the Assembly was a place where you had vigorous debate.
And finally, Mr. Speaker, given criticism like that, given the legislature's low approval ratings, the long days, the long nights, the obnoxious questions from us reporters, do you like your job?
Most days. This is tough work, but it's important. And I am privileged to have the opportunity to try to serve the people of California. I've got a couple of jobs at once. One job is to represent the constituents of my district, and I take that very seriously. And then the second job is to be speaker for the Assembly and hold together the Assembly as an organization, be able to oversee that kind of debate and move forward in trying to turn the economy around. And those are two very difficult jobs, and most of the days they're rewarding, but all of the days they're difficult, and I'm privileged to have that opportunity.
Mr. Speaker, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler was speaking with John Perez, Speaker of the California Assembly. You're listening to Insight. When we come back, how did democracy and tolerance hold up during crises? Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight is online. Joining us with some of what's happening is Insight senior producer Jen Picard. Jen, welcome back.
Well, good morning, and thank you very much. Well, tomorrow, Insight is going on location. We'll be broadcasting live from the Governor's Mansion, where we'll be talking about the planned closure of 70 state parks. The mansion is one of those parks on the closure list. And in the meantime, we wanted to know from you if you had a favorite park on that list. And as it turns out, many of you do. Angela Kingshill likes a few off the list, but Standish Hickey State Park really sticks out for her. She says, while working for the Cal Conservation Corps, where I met my husband of 12 years, we fixed the fire pits and barbecues, and we were hoping to take our kids there. It's a beautiful spot full of campgrounds and nice trails down to the Eel River. Nan Wilkins Fitzpatrick recommends Samuel P. Taylor. It's a beautiful Bay Area retreat in the Redwoods, always full and busy. So sad to see it on the close list. All three of my kids experienced their first camping there. And I have to admit, I actually have a soft spot for Samuel P. Taylor myself, since it was the first camping trip my husband and I ever went on together. And it's really a beautiful place to hike and camp, and it's too bad that it is on that list.
Yeah.
And Janet Miller is going to miss going to the South Yuba River State Park. The closure list doesn't specify which one, although I would assume it's Bridgeport. That will be a sad, sad day when it closes. Do you have a favorite state park on the list? Let us know which one and why by sending an email to insight@capradio.org or by commenting on our Facebook page, Insight at Capital Public Radio.
Well, thank you, Jen.
You're welcome.
It's probably easy to be democratic and tolerant when times are good, but what about when times are bad, during a crisis like World War II or after 9/11? In times like those, we do see selflessness and courage, but we can also see intolerance, even hatred, and the commitment to liberty shakes too. Are these outbursts isolated events or part of a thread that runs through our life? That question is at the heart of a new book titled Manufacturing Hysteria, A History of Scapegoating, Surveillance, and Secrecy in Modern America. The author is Jay Feldman of Davis. He's also written for many of the nation's top magazines and is author of the earlier book, When the Mississippi Ran Backwards. He's in our studio. Jay Feldman, welcome to Inside.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, the title of your book, Manufacturing Hysteria, suggests that the hysteria is deliberate. Is it?
Yes. What we see starting in the months running up to America's entry into World War I is the government whipping the population up into a froth. A new agency created by Woodrow Wilson called the Committee on Public Information, which was nothing but a propaganda arm of the government with the express purpose of creating fear and hatred of everything to do with Germany and Germans, which included German Americans. And the government used that fear and hatred to justify a larger crackdown on civil liberties and a suppression of dissent.
What about during World War II? We've all heard about the deportations of Japanese and Japanese Americans away from the Pacific coast. Was there a similar kind of propaganda effort there?
Well, everybody knows about the evacuation, relocation, and internment of Japanese Americans, but what's largely forgotten is that German and Italian aliens were also interned during World War II. 5,000 conscientious objectors were interned during World War II. 75% of them were Jehovah's Witnesses. So what it comes down to is anybody who is opposed to the war effort in those two cases, World War I and World War II.
My guest is Jay Feldman, author of Manufacturing Hysteria. Let's move closer to the present day, 9/11. Once it became known who the hijackers were of the airplanes, as I recall, President Bush seemed to go to great lengths to make it clear that he was not declaring war on all Muslims. There were public events with him and Muslim leaders and so on. Now, there were wars that the United States undertook in countries with Muslim populations, but there seemed to be a distinct difference there.
Well, at the same time that Bush was saying that, the government was rounding up Muslim and Arab Americans and holding them incommunicado for weeks and even months, in many cases for no other reason than their ethnic identities. So while the words may have been different, the actions were not. And what happened was that these policies had the same kind of chilling effect on the Arab and Muslim communities that the Red Scare following World War II had on the liberal community. You just stop talking after a while because you don't want to attract any attention to yourself. You don't want, to stand out.
Why did you choose to use the word hysteria? It's a very strong word that basically suggests out of control, out of proportion, fear and panic.
Yes. Well, if you look at the history of it, that's exactly what it is. If you look at the attacks that occurred on Germans and German Americans during World War I, including shootings and lynchings, you see that that's what it was, nothing but hysteria. And after World War I, well, it wasn't only Germans, it was also socialists, pacifists, industrial workers of the world, Wobblies, Mennonites, Irish Americans, and all dissenting voices were eventually ostracized. And then following World War I, there was the Red Scare, in which the same thing happened to leftists of all stripes. They were called Bolsheviks, especially at that time, because the Russian Revolution was only a year away. You go through then, and then you get to the Great Depression, and the target now becomes Mexican-Americans. Between 500,000 and 1,000,000 Mexican-Americans were deported during the Depression decade, deported and or, quote, voluntarily repatriated, unquote.
If we group together all the groups of people that you've referred to and others who've been the subject of suspicion and fear over the years, you probably wouldn't have a whole lot of people left in the country if you take out the German Americans, Italian Americans, Jews, African Americans, and so on. I mean, over the years and the decades and even the centuries, it seems like the finger can point at just about anyone and has done up until now.
Right. And when I talk about minorities, it's not only ethnic or racial minorities. It can also be political minorities, as happened in the Red Scares following the two Great Wars. It can also be religious minorities, but it can also be sexual minorities. During the Cold War era, 5,000 homosexuals lost their jobs in the federal government because they were supposed security risks.
Why would they have been considered a security risk?
Well, at that time, everybody was in the closet. And so the premise was that they were subject to blackmail if exposed.
We find that hard to understand today, but couldn't you make the case that there was perhaps some reasonable fear there? That, I mean, if someone is concealing a secret about their life for whatever reason, then aren't they potentially more of a security risk? Because they could be blackmailed more than someone who is able to talk freely about what's going on in the
world. Well, that was the argument that was made.
Yeah.
Whether it's valid or not, I don't know.
Yeah. Is on a related point, I mean, you've studied American history to write the book, but are you confident that if you were the person who's in charge at any given time, that you wouldn't slip into the same track that that leaders have over the years, and not just leaders, but people in the community who get afraid of certain groups of people who are perceived to be a threat?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, and that's probably the heart of the matter, because we all tend to take democracy for granted because we've had it for 200 plus years. And so we assume that it's always going to be here. But in fact, you only have to look at Weimar Germany to see how quickly democracy can go up in smoke. And we should always keep in mind that the National Socialists, the Nazis, did not overthrow any government. They were,
elected democratically.
That's right. And Hitler did not overthrow any leader. He was appointed. So the key to it is that when you scapegoat any minority and begin to infringe on their civil liberties, because scapegoating always brings with it widespread surveillance of the civilian population and secrecy in government. When you limit the civil liberties of any particular group, you've taken the first step toward curtailing the civil liberties of all.
My guest is Jay Feldman, author of Manufacturing Hysteria. Is this something you see in particular in America, or is it universal?
I'm glad you asked. No, of course, it happens everywhere. But as an American, I'm most interested in the history as it happened here. And as Americans, we've also always been taught that we should hold ourselves to a higher standard. And if that's the case, then we need to go back and reintegrate this dark side of our history, which has been, because there are so many admirable and honorable things about this country, we tend to airbrush out this dark side of our history.
How do you stop yourself from scapegoating others for problems you see?
Well, I think the first thing you have to be is aware of the process, aware how it happens, and go back and look through the history as it's happened, and be vigilant for instances of it in today.
But you're a well-educated guy. You went to UC Berkeley, part of the free speech movement. You presumably would consider yourself a progressive person. What about society at large? What's the solution for society at large to avoid scapegoating people?
Well, that's a really good question, and if I had the answer to that, I'd write another book.
Yes.
All I can do is have put it out there and hope that it has some effect.
And people can meet you and talk about the book at a couple of events you got coming up here, this Friday.
Yes.
At the Avid Reader in Davis. That's in the evening.
Yes, it is 7:30.
And Sunday at the Avid Reader in Sacramento at 2 p.m.
Correct.
Jay Feldman, he's author of Manufacturing Hysteria. The subtitle is A History of Scapegoating, Surveillance, and Secrecy in Modern America. Jay, thanks for joining us.
Oh, the pleasure's been mine.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, we'll talk about Tom Sawyer with one of the world's leading experts on Mark Twain. You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. What's in the news today? Joining us is Alan Ray, Capital Public Radio senior editor in our newsroom. Alan, what's in the news?
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. Having just got back from the area, I can tell there's a lot of stuff going on in the Sierra ski areas. Big changes coming. For instance, lots of construction going on now at North Star, and Squaw Valley, USA, and neighboring Alpine Meadows are combining operations. This comes as the Lake Tahoe area considers making a bid for a future Winter Olympics. The neighboring resorts are likely to make that announcement later today.
Okay.
The cost of health insurance for most of us increased far more than we got paid in terms of increases, outstripping any worker wage increases, adding more uncertainty to the pace of the rising medical costs here. New study by the Kaiser Family Foundation shows the average annual premium for family coverage through an employer reached more than $15,000.
Oh, my goodness.
Year. Yeah. Those stories and more on All Things Considered this afternoon on Capital Public Radio.
Alan Ray, thanks.
My pleasure.
One of the most popular books by one of America's greatest authors will get a lot of extra attention over the next month or so in Sacramento. That's because The Adventures of Tom Sawyer by Mark Twain is the novel chosen for this year's Big Read, One Book Sacramento. Community events around the book kick off this week, including a talk by one of the world's leading experts on Twain. He's Robert Hurst, general editor of the Mark Twain Project and curator of the Mark Twain Papers at UC Berkeley. The Mark Twain Project was behind the hugely successful publication last year of the first volume of Mark Twain's autobiography. Robert Hurst, welcome to Inside.
Glad to be here.
Well, Tom Sawyer is one of Mark Twain's most popular works, but where do you think it fits in his canon? How important and significant is it?
Well, it's an early success. It's his first novel, really, independent novel. He writes The Gilded Age with Charles Dudley Warner first, but that's really not a complete novel from his point of view. It's the beginning of what he's really known for now. It leads literally into the writing of Huckleberry Finn. And one of the reasons you want to read it is so that you can see him evolving into the author of Huckleberry Finn. I always say that Tom Sawyer is checkers and Huck Finn is chess.
Tom Sawyer seems to be more like a collection of vignettes or sketches than a novel.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Is it a novel?
No. Depends on how you define novel, of course. It's not a novel in the sense that Jane Austen writes novels or that Henry James writes novels. It's more like a novel that Defoe writes. It's in that tradition, really, of the picaresque tradition, in which basically one damn thing after another occurs. Mark Twain himself says, there's no plot to the thing. And what he means by that is he has not planned it all the way through to the end so that you have a kind of rising curve and then a descending curve that characterizes most novels of that we think of as novels. But Defoe wrote novels, and so did other 18th century writers of this kind. And Mark Twain is in that tradition.
Who do you think he had in mind when he was writing it? Adults, but kids would be welcome to read it, or kids and adults would be welcome to read it?
Well, it's hard for me to say what he had in mind, because it looks as though, given the evidence, the letters that he writes at the time, that he had both audiences in mind and really could not make up his mind whether this was a book for children or a book for adults, even after he'd gotten all the way through to the end of it. And I think the reason he couldn't really decide is that the answer is that it's both. I always say that the principle behind such a story is that it's designed so that the adults who are reading it to their children, if that's what's happening, they get a kind of pleasure that's theirs, and the children get a different kind of pleasure. I call it the Trespassers W syndrome that comes from Pooh's story. They discover a sign that says Trespassers W, and of course the characters don't know what it means, and they think it means... Well, Piglet says it means Trespassers Will, which is short for Trespassers William, which is his grandfather's name, and so forth. He totally misunderstands, really, what it is. But the adults, of course, do understand. So actually, there are many incidents in Tom Sawyer that have that double interest. And there are many jokes that I think it's pretty clear no child is going to get, certainly not today, and maybe not even then.
My guest is a Mark Twain scholar, Robert Hurst. He is head of the Mark Twain Project and the Mark Twain Papers, and he's going to be speaking in Sacramento this Thursday evening at the kickoff of the Big Read One Book Sacramento Project. This year's book will be The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. Do we know what Mark Twain had in mind when he was writing the book? Did he see this as the start of the successful part of his career?
Well, you can say that although he'd written essentially travel books up until that time, and long before that had basically been a journalist and actually remained a journalist for the rest of his career, this is the first novel, a real novel, that he does on his own. And he is ambitious to write novels because that is, in fact, the expected and sort of accepted high road for literary figures. Mark Twain, as a humorist, had to face the fact that... humor was not considered high literature. It was literature of a low order, as he says. And he actually changes that by virtue of writing Huckleberry Finn and by virtue of Tom Sawyer as well.
Did that bother him?
Oh, it bothered him.
Oh, it did?
It bothered him. It bothered him enough so that he tried to change it. I mean, even his fiancée, I mean, had disapproving thoughts about being a humorist. He tells Jill Twitchell that, you know, if anybody could persuade her that I was not a humorist, that they would have undying loyalty from Livy. And simply because the notion that writing things that are funny was not something that people could take in as, you know, as serious literature. So, for instance, the family urges him to write Prince and the Pauper and later on to write about Joan of Arc because they think of those as serious novels.
Mm. Well, he might be disappointed if he were to find that humorists today would probably see the same thing, the same experience.
Well, I suppose that's right. It seems to me they have a little better standing than they used to. I mean, he compares himself, for instance, to all the other humorists who are writing and also on the lecture circuit at the time. I mean, Artemus Ward, Petroleum V. Nasby, people you've never heard of, I'm sure, because they disappear from the public view before Mark Twain dies. And he says, basically, I'm lucky if I last another, you know, 30 years. And really, the lasting power of humor is what limits it.
Was the book successful when it came out? Was it a hit?
Well, it was a hit. It was not as good a success as he wanted because the absence of an international copyright law meant that the Canadians could steal the proofs and set up their own edition, import it into the United States, and sell it for less than half of what he was selling his book for.
Sounds like the equivalent of illegal downloading at that time.
That is literally what it is. I mean, and there was just almost nothing you could do about it. The American law at the time said simply that if you were caught doing this, the books would be confiscated. And he objects to that. He says, you know, if this were American Treasury notes, you wouldn't just confiscate them, you'd do something else. You'd put them in jail. But of course, that law is never not strengthened for some time.
Robert Hurst of the Mark Twain Project and the Mark Twain Papers. The Mark Twain Project published the first volume of Mark Twain's huge autobiography, and it was a big success.
Yes, it was.
Were you all surprised at the level of success?
I think we would have been very odd if we weren't surprised. I think we certainly knew that it was going to be more popular than, let's say, one of our volumes of letters or something like that. But I think if you asked me at the time of publication, I would have said, you know, we'll be lucky to do 10,000.
And how many did it sell?
It is now, they've now printed 430,000 and have sold more than 70,000 Kindle versions of it. So we're at the half million mark.
And for a book that is A, very large, and B, over 100 years old.
Yeah,
scholarly.
Yeah, I mean, 100 years old and Mark Twain, that's the kind of thing that sells it. But it's a scholarly edition. That's one of the reasons we were as surprised as we were. We did our best to kind of shape the scholarly edition so that it was a little more appealing to the general reader than it would otherwise have been. I mean, I've seen people complain about the introduction, which is about 50 pages long, but a normal introduction for a scholarly edition would be 100 pages long, easily.
Wow. Well, I don't know if Mark Twain would have approved, but the electronic version of the book is available free online. And
that is correct. I think he would have approved. So long as he was getting some income from it, I think that would be the criterion. It's not that he needed to have a lot of money. I mean, for instance, when Tauchnitz wanted to reprint his books in Germany, Tauchnitz would always offer to pay him £300, which was trivial. But it was the request for permission and that token payment that made Tauchnitz different from the pirates like John Camden Hotten and things like that.
And if you want to read that first volume of the autobiography, we'll put a link on our website at capradio.org/insight. Robert, when does volume two come out? I assume that your editors are hard at work on it.
They are hard at work on it. And I keep asking them, can't we make this go a little faster? And they say, they say, Bob, you know very well that we're working as fast as we can. I think it's we will be done and submit the printer's copy about June of the coming year, and it'll take about a year for it to go through the printing process and be out there in June of 2013.
And there'll be a volume three?
There will be a volume three, for sure.
That's some time off.
But you have about the same problem. I say you can't really do two volumes at once with the size of the staff we have. And so basically it's one thing after another. And the next draw after they finish in June will be working on volume three. And then, of course, proofreading volume two. So it may seem slow to the world, probably is slow as far as the world is going. But this is the scholarly world in part. So.
Robert Hurst, general editor of the Mark Twain Project, curator of the Mark Twain Papers. He'll be in Sacramento this Thursday evening at 6 at the Sacramento Central Library's Sicopolis Galleria, talking about Mark Twain and Tom Sawyer. The Adventures of Tom Sawyer is this year's Big Read One Book Sacramento. A month or so worth of events kick off this week. Robert Hurst, thanks so much for joining us.
Very glad to be here.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the top stories in local news with David Watts Barton. We'll also hear why he's no longer the editor of the Sacramento Press. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Shark warning signs are posted today along part of California's central coast. Several times in recent days, there have been sightings of a shark about 12 feet long around Shell Beach in Cayucos. But whether everyone stays out of the water is another matter. It's a beautiful day today around this part, sunny in Cayucos with an expected high of 81. You can step out in the nice weather today in Grass Valley to go to Fall Fashion Show at lunchtime. It's a fundraiser for Animal Save, specifically its Spay Neuter Clinic and other pet programs. The fashion show starts at 11 at Alta Sierra Country Club today in Grass Valley. It's going to be 82 and sunny, 90 in Sacramento, 89 in Stockton, 81 in Carson City, Tahoe City 73 today, a little bit warmer tomorrow. Each Tuesday, we've been talking about top stories in local news with David Watts Barton, editor-in-chief of the online newspaper, The Sacramento Press. Well, David joins us again today, but no longer in that capacity. As you might have already heard, he and The Sacramento Press parted ways last week. David, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here, as always.
Well, what happened?
Well, I got laid off, just like that. They are trying to cut back their expenses and get the company to profitability. It's been 3 years now, almost 3 years next month since they launched, and a couple years at least before that of building the site. So I'm happy to say I was one of the highest paid people there, which is new for me, but not so much anymore. And there was one other person, another department head, was also laid off.
And what does that say about Sacramento Press? Should people who read it be concerned?
Well, you know, it's a startup, and it's a new thing, and they've invested a lot of money in it and have hired a lot of people, and I don't know. I'm assuming that it will go on and that it's going to, they're going to figure it out, and I think that me being gone was part of them figuring it out, so.
And what are you going to do next? I could mention that you will be guest hosting Insight a little more often every other Friday, starting this Friday. But apart from that august responsibility.
Right. Well, so far, that's just about it. But it's nice to have something. I do some occasional reporting for Bloomberg News out of New York, some court reporting things, not court reporting, but reporting on court cases. So I'll be doing that. And we'll see.
We'll see.
I don't know.
But since you're here, we're going to talk about some stories in the news, including something very interesting that you checked out in Midtown.
I stopped by yesterday, Capitol Stage, which has been on the Delta King for several years, in a kind of a nice theater, but kind of out of the way. Has moved into an old gun shop on J Street that most people would recognize there between 22nd and 23rd. There was a giant painting of a gun on the wall.
Oh, yeah.
And that's gone now, and they have a big red wall. It says Capitol Stage. And I stopped by. A friend of mine is a stagehand, and she was there working, as it turns out, with several other members of Union Local 50, and they're all helping build this thing out, volunteering to help build this out. That said, it's going to be an equity house, which means it's full-scale paid actors, like B Street Theater, like Sacramento Theater Company, like Music Circus. And they're going to be doing a lot of shows. They've already got a season scheduled. The first show is by a playwright I don't know named Tracy Letts. It's called Superior Donuts. It's the first time anybody's done one of his plays in Sacramento. They're going to open the first show on October 7th, which I believe is a week from this Friday. And it seats about 125 people. And it's kind of in a U shape. They're still setting it up, but it looks great. I mean, it'll be really nice, and it's right in Midtown. So, you know, with that opening, and then once the B Street Theater gets over on Capitol, we're going to be developing kind of a little theater district that'll be much more central, and I think it'll be really nice. So I'm very excited about that.
My guest is David Watts Barton. Anything else in the news that catches your attention?
Well, since I'm not responsible for knowing everything that's going on anymore, which is kind of fun. The Planning Commission did approve the Powerhouse Science Center over there on off of Jaboom Street between the freeway and the river. It's the old PG&E power plant that was built in, I believe, the 30s, and it's a really nice old building.
Beautiful old building, but just sort of looking worse for wear and in the middle of nowhere, kind
of. Yeah, yeah. Well, the funny thing is it's far from any in the middle of nowhere. It's right in the center of, you know, this whole area, the rail yards area that's going to be developed. It's just that it's not particularly accessible, and it's been surrounded by fields, and there's a water treatment plant right there, or a processing plant of some sort on the river. But other than that, there's not much there. But what they're going to do is they have a $50 million budget, which is already set, and they're going to start construction next spring, and then hopefully it'll be open the year after that. And what it is it's the science center that's been out on Auburn Boulevard for a long time. They're going to be moving that that's been there since I was a kid. And they're going to move that down into this new building, expand it. I think they're talking about a planetarium. It's going to be a very green building. And so I think it's a huge boost to the downtown. And it's going to sort of fit in with a lot of these other things that have happened, like the Crocker and hopefully the arena.
And close to Old Sacramento and the rail yards.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, you know, we're really developing a bit of a tourist area down there now. You know, something that a lot of Sacramentans don't necessarily go to very much. But I think this will change that because it is so close. And it's right off the bike trail. It's going to have bike trail access. So, could be nice.
Anything else?
Well, there is there's the city. The arena is still in the news, as it is every week we talk. They're going to the council tonight to discuss the possibility of earmarking $555,000, i.e., $500,000, to hire some consultants and really do feasibility studies on all the different aspects that have been spoken about in these past reports in the Big Sacramento report that came out a few weeks ago, when they said, you know, this is the menu of options. Well, now they're really going to go in and they're going to really look at the options, and they're going to hire some of these people, including the guy who appeared at that meeting, Dan Barrett, who does arena building. And the other thing about the arena, sorry, is that they're also AEG, which is a big operator. They operate the Kansas City arena that was just built recently. And they work with Icon, who's working with David Taylor here to do this arena. They have expressed an interest in operating it, and they're one of the biggest arena operators in the world. So with their interest in that, I mean, it still comes down to the money. But at least there are a lot of very big players with a lot of interest, and there's a lot of movement forward on this still.
But quite a bit of money up front from the city, it looks like, for these consultants and so on. And just very quickly, there is something opened up in Midtown. A lot of restaurants have been closing recently, but just very quickly, something has opened up.
Yeah, Temple Coffee on 10th Street used to be in the old Levinson's Books building. There are some people who had a place called Bloom Coffee in Roseville, and they're opening a place there called Broadacre Coffee. Supposedly it's going to open anytime, sometime in the next week or so.
Excellent. David Watts Barton, journalist and guest host of Insight. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And good luck.
Thanks.
By the way, we have an update from Capital Public Radio reporter Ben Adler. He says Jerry Brown has just signed two bills that Assembly Speaker John Perez mentioned in our interview earlier in today's Insight. Both deal with streamlining California's environmental review process. One applies only to a potential future NFL stadium in Los Angeles. The other applies to certain large development projects across the state as designated by the governor. Well, that's Insight for today. Tomorrow, we're live at the governor's mansion. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Our associate producers today, Lynn Weaver and Liz Cazares. The assistant producer, James Morrison. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. And the senior producer is Jen Picard. We'll see you tomorrow. 70 state parks are slated for closure in the coming year due to budget cuts. The governor's mansion in Sacramento is one of those parks. On a special live broadcast of Insight from the governor's mansion, we'll talk about the status of California's parks and how private foundations might be able to help. Plus, we'll take you on a tour of the mansion and talk about what's happening with the fund to build a new official residence for California's governor. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
10 a.m. tomorrow on Capital Public Radio.